Institute. Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Your ultimate culinary companion.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
Welcome to another episode of Dishing It Out with me, Gary O'Hanlon.
And me, Gareth Mullins.
And coming up today, one of my favourite comedians of all time, Pat Short of the Unbelievables or Dunbelievables or whatever way you want to pronounce it. He is an absolute Stonewall legend. He's a mad biker like our boy Gareth over there. Travels the world. Just a brilliant, brilliant cat. Looking forward to chatting to him, Gareth. What about you?
Yeah, and I actually do a little bit of work with his daughter. She does some social media stuff for us.
Brilliant, so, yeah.
I was only talking to her not too long ago about, and she was saying he's an avid cook, so let's see.
Yeah, because they're touring together right now, aren't they?
Yeah, yeah, they've a new show that's been going on. I think it's in and around, well, we'll find out. Like, I think it started in and around COVID.
Yeah.
So she's a very, very funny girl as well. So,
yeah.
I mean, she didn't nick it off his tongue. He's going to be a high energy, I'd imagine.
I know, geez, I was going to say, man, I've been going to shows of his from as far back as the mid-90s, you know, like in Galway in the Black Box Theatre. Just brilliant. I can't wait. Done a few 6 o'clock shows with him over the years, and just a brilliant guy, great actor too. So we'll touch on all of his career. We're going to have the usual ingredient of the week and our culinary conundrums. Don't go anywhere.
Next up, we've got our ingredient of the week. Gary, what have you got this week?
I'm going to go bang in season asparagus, much to your annoyance. I'd say you really wanted to do that, didn't you?
Do you know what?
We have this wee ongoing sort of a battle, don't we? Who picks the best ingredients?
I've actually got my first batch of white asparagus.
Yeah.
So it's literally just coming into the kitchens now. So haven't seen any of the green stuff yet, but it will start. And it is a thing that just really eats so much better when it is in season.
No.
I know you can get it a lot of the year round.
But I suppose, yeah, you have the British and Irish one, you know what I mean? The British would have a great reputation, actually, for the quality of their asparagus. It takes a long time to grow it as well. I think I'm not sure, actually, once it grows for the first time, does it keep coming back? But I think it takes 3 years for the original
stems to grow. That's how it works. The first couple of years, you don't get much, and then when you start getting it. I like it when it gets a little bit thicker. Like, I know the really thin, the pencil stuff is nice, but I actually like the stuff that has a bit more.
Well, the pencil stuff, it's almost like they call it nearly wild asparagus, and it's really light, really delicate, beautiful with fish. But again, it's almost gone off the palate before you've really felt any texture or bite to it and flavour. So I would definitely be with you. I'd be kind of in the happy medium. I'm not mad about it when I find it can be a wee bit too woody if it gets too big. But equally, and here's one thing as well, that anybody that doesn't do it, if you don't peel it from the stem down, I really do judge you. You got to take at least an inch or an inch and a half off the base off it. It's far too woody. You can't eat that bottom, almost purple-like part of it. And then right where the bud ends, you'll see some chefs like to kind of come down maybe halfway now. It's like a wee bit of a funky signature you'll see now, and you get that perfect line, and then it's peeled from there.
I done that asparagus for that dinner we done. Remember you and I cooked that dinner up in the REIs for 1,000 people?
Yeah, and you peeled them like that?
Well, I didn't, but yeah.
Which you made some poor lad do it.
Yeah.
Oh man, that's right. You did the filet mignon dish.
Yeah. Roasted onion and peeled asparagus. Yeah.
Oh, Jesus
Christ. They were looking at me going, "We have to peel it." I'm like, "Yeah, we have to peel it. What do you mean we have to peel it?"
What a hero. You wouldn't do that now, though, but you're probably young and trying to be a hero.
Yeah, exactly. I was trying to be analog.
But it's a really beautiful vegetable on its own, you know, whether it's in a risotto, you can really, like, it just carries so much flavor. Yeah, and great texture as well, you know, like asparagus just as a mimosa, like, you know, egg white or like a grated yolk over the top of it is a classic breakfast. A little bit of Parma ham, obviously grilled then with salmon, it's really, really nice. I mean, it takes to any kind of seafood or meats, poultry. It is one of the most versatile vegetables.
It lends itself so well to hollandaise.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, it's hollandaise.
Asparagus and butter is a match made in heaven. Yeah, it really, really is. And what are you going to go with, Gareth?
So I'm going to go with a Dublin Bay prawn or a langoustine, as you're probably used to what they're called in
France. Dublin Bay prawns too, yeah.
So a Dublin Bay prawn is totally different to a tiger prawn. I think most people, most home cooks will be finding tiger prawns, which are coming from the Indian Ocean somewhere, or maybe out as far as Vietnam. But we do get langoustines or Dublin Bay prawns.
They're actually not caught off Dublin Bay. Well, they are, but I mean, the Porcupine Bank, I think, is on off further off the west coast of Ireland, whenever they're mainly caught.
And they're a tricky ingredient to cook, because they don't take much cooking, as you well know. And if you get them a bit bigger, like just cutting them half and grilling them with garlic butter is amazing. You can obviously poach them, which they're also fantastic. They're not cheap. They're definitely a luxury product.
Yeah.
We do use them in work. I don't think I'll use that much of them when I'm at home. But if you are on your holidays and you're near a little fishing village, go and try and get a few and just throw them on a barbecue. Yeah. The meat in them is like much sweeter than a tiger prawn. And they're very delicate, very delicious.
I suppose if you're a fan of lobster, it's not a million miles. The texture is almost identical, isn't it?
Yeah, not as tough.
Not as tough, softer. It's definitely softer, more tender for sure, yeah. I love them with a bit of texture wrapped in kataifi pastry. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, you just soak them in some egg white, salt, white pepper, lemon, lime juice, and then fresh coriander. You just soak them in the egg white and then roll them. You just sort of tear off strands of kataifi pastry. You roll it up in a little roulade, almost like you get two or three layers of kataifi, deep fat fry them, toss them in salt, mango mayonnaise, a little bit of red onion compote, salted ricotta, lemon juice, olive oil, beautiful. You know, how do you eat them?
Yeah, I think that the nicest thing to do with them, I think, is just to very simply grill them. I think them grilled with garlic butter and like, you just need a bowl to wash your hands and then throw a bib on and get stuck in.
The torture is the peeling, really.
Yeah, yeah, but they're just so delicious. The meat is so sweet. So
I'm not mad into too much seafood now, but I do like a prawn here and there. You know what I mean? But I wouldn't go out of my way for them, though, gotta be honest. But that's just me. I'm more into the cod, ling, that sort of stuff. Like, I'm not mad about shellfish, really.
Right.
Yeah, I can appreciate it and obviously use a lot of it, cook a lot of it, but I wouldn't be knocking down your door for a lot of it at the same. But that's just personal preference, you know. And two good ones this week.
Okay, cool.
So we have one of the absolute biggest comedic legends this country's ever seen. I've hunted him down for the last week or two. I'm going to go circa 98 or 99. I was ducking my head in the Black Box Theatre in Galway, praying to the Almighty himself that the fucker wouldn't find me in the crowd. He was about two people away from me. Pat Short, welcome. Welcome to dishing it out.
You'd have spotted him.
Oh, yeah. You would have caught me back then.
Shine off him.
Jesus. I'll never forget it, man. I was there with Kevin O'Donoghue, an old buddy of mine from Clarenbridge in Galway. We were working in Galway at the time of Salt Hill Hotel. And we went to watch you and John at the Black Box Theatre.
And a few years ago.
It was. I was there from 97 and 99, and then I went to Boston. So I'm going to say 98 or 99.
No, I would have thought
you might have been on tour around then.
Yeah, yeah.
But I saw you in a couple of places, but that night in Galway beat all, probably because Kevin was the biggest, and Vinny, there was another boy with me from Westport. Just mad fans of both of you, as was I. Yeah. But Jesus, you plucked somebody from the crowd that was right beside me and Kevin that night, and I genuinely was like, praying. I was like, please, please don't pull me up on that stage, because you fuckers used to butcher whoever got
we were always kind of nice to people, you know what I mean? But we bring them up, but you didn't do. I remember those, and we did it in the last show as well. Faye was with me and doing it, and we'd bring up a fella to go, she was going to leave with him, and then she'd say, look, hang on there, I want to have a word with you. I'm tell your man to head away, and she'd give him the suitcases, but we'd often fill the suitcases with blocks. He'd have to climb his way down the steps and head off down the theatre. Well, you do also some mad shit for the crack.
Yeah. And yourself and John, I mean, I suppose, was that whenever, you know, had you been doing stand-up or any sort of theatre prior to you and John getting together? Or how did that relationship start?
I play saxophone. I play a lot of jazz and that. So I went to art college in Limerick, and my brother was a photographer. And he had done work with Theatre Omnibus, as a theatre company, which John was part of. And then John went out in his own solo career, and Tom had done all the photography for John's. He had the single Spancer Lil at the time, and all the posters and that kind of stuff. So I met John when I was going down to Limerick, and we had a session. John's a great musician and singer himself. And I think we had a music session in Turles one night. And he said, James, if you're ever up in Limerick, I'm doing Wednesday nights in Costello's. Come up and bring the sax with you. So I was like, I went to art college because I was good at art, obviously, and liked it. But really, was kind of I couldn't get into music college, and that's where I kind of wanted to go. So I brought the sax with me down to Limerick School of Art, and I'd spent more time playing sax with bands than painting pictures. But I used to do Wednesday nights with John, get up and play with him, have the crack. And kind of around Christmas time, he had a sound engineer, gas man, Keith. And Keith, who was it? Howard Jones. Do you remember Howard Jones? Howard Jones, kind of synthy music of the 80s. Right. He came on tour in Ireland, and Keith was a huge fan of Howard Jones. So he took off following Howard Jones around the country, literally hitching from Belfast to follow. Went to every show he did and left John down. John had no sound engineer. So I knew the gig at that stage. So I stepped in and took over sound and lights with John. And I spent 4 years doing sound with him.
Wow.
And writing sketches with him and having the crack and jumping up playing sax. And eventually, after the 4 years, it got to the stage where we were nearly doing more, the two of us together, than John on his own. So that's when we formed, it was John Kenny and Pat Short. And then the following year, we wrote a show called One Hell of a... The first show was It's My Shout. And then we wrote One Hell of a Do. And in that was a wedding band called... The band were called Dumbelievables. That was the two characters. And they... People just loved that show and those characters. And it got to the stage where we became known as Dumbelievables instead of, you know, instead of the characters, which was funny. So we kind of, we then took on the Unbelievables as our characters' names, even though we'd moved away from those two characters in the show. And we became known as Dumbelievables.
And
which
is
weird.
Art still a part of your life?
It is, yeah. I mean, I don't exhibit. I've been asked to exhibit it. So I still do a lot of drawing. When you're off on a movie or something like that and you're away for maybe 3 or 4 months and you've got downtime and you're away maybe a different country or something, that's a great time to have a sketch pad with you. And
then what is it you draw, do you? Or
I draw, whatever. I love pencils, line drawing, that kind of stuff. And I draw, I just landscape and like that, I draw myself. When I'm bored looking out the window.
And have you ever exhibited anything? That
no, I have. I haven't. I did. No, I did in college. I think I did. I was in a couple of exhibitions, but I just it's not for. I don't.
Is that a fear of
it
of
is
not being sold?
pure shite on. And it's like something I love doing.
You must have a fucking big bank of gear then, do you? Like or stuff.
I have a load of pencils and I have a topper. I have a load of rubbers. Rubbing it out. No, it's something I like doing, but it's not drawing is a bit like music. Yeah. It's like anything like that. You need to practice. You need to keep it. Get the muscle.
It's like cooking.
It's like cooking, I suppose. Yeah. And could you imagine stepping away from cooking for 2 years or a year then go back to doing something? You'd be kind of all over the place a little bit, you know? And I'm like that with the drawing. I love drawing, but I don't do enough of it.
You have to find your rhythm with it, I suppose.
Yeah. You got to keep it up.
It's like, and do you cook?
I love cooking, yeah. Jesus, I'm mad into me cooking. I had a bar restaurant for about 8 years or so.
Oh, well,
yeah.
Near Castle Martyr, right?
Castle Martyr, yeah.
And were you working in it? Or?
No, I was just drinking.
Playing the sax, but you're not listening.
Well, no, it's a long, long story. My brother's a chef, and I bought it, and he was finishing up something. He'd wanted to get his own place going. Then once we got it, he didn't want it, and he walked away and left me with the fucking thing.
Oh, no.
Oh, what an nightmare. And you guys know what that's like.
Yeah.
So I had to kind of make a go of it, and like... Dealing with chefs can be contrary.
Oh yeah.
But when you get a good chef, a great chef, it's fucking
It's easy. Well, you think it's like golf. You think you're never going to have another bad game ever again. You get a good chef and you think, Jesus, what was all the worrying about?
I loved it. I really enjoyed it and we had a great fun there. But when he left, I kind of lost really any interest in it. But I was away touring away. So what I loved was coming back. I'd spend a few days down there because it was in Cork. I live in Limerick. So I'd go down and spend a few days, which was a real pain in the ass because I spent like maybe 6 months in America touring and doing shows. And then I'd come back and the first thing I'd have to do is go straight down to Cork to
check
in.
Yeah, exactly, and see how things were going. But he was a brilliant chef, great character, good friend of mine, great musician as well. Mike Hanran from Stockton's Wing, actually, was who it was. And we had great fun putting menus together and stuff like that. And some great nights down there, you know.
Yeah. And was it a traditional type of food?
Irish food.
It was a lovely bar, actually.
Beautiful.
I did go in.
I was
in it.
Like some of the salads were maybe kind of influenced by Ottolenghi, that kind of stuff.
Oh, well.
You know what I mean?
Well,
so then we, it was a traditional Irish bar, which we wanted to kind of
play close to.
Yeah, because I was into, like, I'm a traditional musician as well, so traditional music is another thing as well. And it wasn't just the food, it's the whole, the bar. It was a beautiful old bar which lent itself to that. And then I'd have traditional music sessions and stuff like that as well. So, yeah, wanted to keep that whole shtick, to it, and I think it worked really, really well.
And was food a big part of life growing up?
It's one of those things you don't think about it, but it was, because my dad was
a 11, he's in the house, he's fighting over the funds anyway.
But my dad was a great gardener, so we grew up with, like, all vegetables ourselves, and potatoes and strawberries and cucumbers and marrows. And
see, Gareth's a city boy, he wouldn't understand this, you know, but this is something that was normal.
Especially with a big family, we had a big, big garden.
Yeah.
So, without thinking, you grew up with fresh everything.
What we've learned by doing this every week, people go, oh, no, not really. And then when you start talking about it, we're going, oh, actually, should we eat fresh food every day?
Yeah. And of course, back in those days too, like with a big family, we ate a lot of offal and stuff.
Mm. Yeah.
So you had livers and bacon. Yeah. And my dad used to trade with the butcher, he'd give him some jams and stuff like that.
Right.
He'd give him some meats. You know, it was that kind of thing went on a bit
of bartering,
A bit of bartering, which was a bit of fun, like more so than a
But did everybody get amongst it in the house? Did everybody cook a little bit?
My mum died when we were all very young. So we had, everyone had their night to make bread, for example. So I could be on Tuesday making bread, so on the lads the next day, Wednesday, and Thursday the next. And that's how it rotates. So once a week you were doing baking, and another you were making the dinner, then other days. And we had a great neighbour come in and helped us out because my dad was working. We were all in school and that kind of thing. But it was really
that's
good.
That's tough
food.
Too, though, you know. I mean, I don't know anybody whose parents are still alive, how fortunate they are. I mean, you know, I have friends that lost a mammy or a dad. Daddy young, like, and it has to be the worst
you get on with it, you know. Yeah. You don't actually, when you're young,
how young was I?
Seven, and
seven,
the youngest was four, and the eldest was 16. So,
so
it's kind of a tight packed bunch of us, you know what I mean? Yeah. But you don't think of it, you know. I mean,
and when it's a big family, like I'm from the seven of us, you know, and your brothers and sisters kind of help look after you, you know, you're the second youngest, so. One of my brothers, I'd never remember living with him. He was gone.
Well, there you go.
He was out working, like, you know.
Yeah, the eldest in our family was the same. It kind of ended up nearly with seven boys growing up together in the house, because the girls had gone off to college.
Bank and shite, Ellen.
Brian Benson, he was for hitting. Yeah. Not for cooking.
I'm trying to make bread here. Stop hitting me.
Exactly. A bit like that. Jesus.
Yeah, there'd be some rumbles, all right. Hey, there's only five in our house, and one of them was a girl, but yeah, you'd still be batting.
She was the toughest bloody.
Yeah. You'd have fuck out of you, yeah. No bother. That's for sure. Yeah. And then I'm trying to think, like, are you the man's responsible for making the breakfast roll famous, or was it always famous?
I suppose I am, in a funny kind of way.
Jeez, it was magic.
It was a funny time. Like, I mean, that song, there's a sketch we did as The Unbelievables, if you remember it, called Two of Them and One of Them. And Two.
Oh, jeez. Well, that's the greatest sketch of all time.
It's a great sketch.
Of all time. I wonder if Gareth's seen it. Yeah.
It's a kid.
I tell you, you actually want to drag John Kenny through the computer screen or the TV and say, would you fucking stop? It's unbelievably annoying, isn't it? Jesus.
But it's that when you go into a shop, there's a young fella in front of you and you go, how much are the two of them? How much are there? And you're going, oh, just give me the fucking sweet. I'll buy the fucking things. So I was heading to work one day in the office, and they were building the motorway up the road for us, which is now the M7 down outside Limerick. And of course, I'd go to the office around 10 in the morning, but that coincided perfectly with the break for all the builders. And there'd be lads in high vis in front of me. And it was like the oomphle in the shop. They're now going, 2 eggs, 2 sausages, what do you want to that? Do you want the sauce? Go over there. Yeah. This was, you'd be waiting to get your
meat. And a fucking heart appointment in the matter when you're at it.
Yeah. and that was another funny thing. You know, people don't even listen to the song. It just had that infectious kind of thing.
Yeah.
But I got a big write-up in The Independent once saying how bad the song was for people's health.
Ah, jeez.
You know, it's encouraging people to eat 2 sausages. And if you actually listen to the song, it's about a fella who used to eat 2 sausages.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's given it up. And he's now a vegan. And he's after meeting a young one. He's lost 3 stone. And the following week, someone pointed it out to him in a letter and they apologised.
Oh, yeah. That's deadly.
Oh, jeez. It was refusing.
Yeah, well, that's it. Exactly.
It's mad. Tell you, the Irish petrol station has a lot to answer for, you know, with the chicken fillet roll and the breakfast roll.
Yeah.
I mean, two staples. Oh, there's us going around the world trying to spread the gospel of Irish food.
I know my young Fletcher, he's pizzas and chicken rolls, and it's all chicken rolls. He's a generation. He's about 20.
Yeah.
And it's just chicken rolls. It was breakfast rolls. And I remember when I brought out the song, there's a guy in a garage, you know, you're travelling the country, and I pulled in, he says, Jesus, shot. I thought we were fucked. I was only have to put a new kitchen in. And you brought out that song, and I thought, Jesus, we've never been busy.
Well, you're definitely good for business, yeah. Joe Raleigh's a good buddy of mine. When I used to work in Ireland, I was in Viewmount House, and right beside it, there's a petrol station, and he's a good golfing buddy of mine, too.
Yeah.
But I mean, the deli is just, I mean, any construction work at all, you chat about the high-vis vest. I mean, there's those certain times of the day where they're just like 10 deep at the counter, man. And you just think to yourself, Jesus, can any of you boys make a packed lunch for yourself? Like, you know what I mean?
Does anyone ever make a sandwich anymore?
No, they must not. I mean, my wife's a school teacher, like, and Jesus, she's fucking cooking turkey burgers and roasting sweet potatoes every night. And as I go, it costs me fucking 800 a week to send her to school. So it does, you know what I mean? I wish there was a petrol station beside her school. But it's true. I'm just like going, Jesus, like, these boys are dropping serious coin, man. Yeah. Fucking stuff.
But the standard of that offering has gotten an awful lot better.
Well, yeah, I'm touring near 30 something years now, and trying to get something to eat before, you were literally
Mars
Kentucky Fried Chicken.
Yeah,
well, you've tried like chicken box, and that was it.
Yeah,
you know? You're not long back. I mean, we were just chatting there off air, Pat. You're an avid biker as well.
Yes.
I know. I mean, I'm only new to that game. Sorry, Nettie. And Gareth has had a bike for a long time, but you probably find that when you're not long back from touring Europe, or I remember looking at and seeing the jealousy all over my face. You're sending pictures of being all over Turkey or wherever else.
That's right, yeah,
but it's, you know, and I'm over and back to France these last 5 years.
Yeah.
But geez, there's times you come off the motorway and you'd be like, going, I wish it was like, why can't the petrol stations over here just have some fucking something half wholesome at least?
Oh,
like,
but in Europe.
You can eat nothing but
sausages.
Proper shit.
No,
like,
it's awful.
When you're on the road over in Europe, they could learn a lot from our own petrol stations here.
Yeah,
but how do you find that then when you're on like those big bike trips you go on? Like, I suppose you have it all mapped out. You just go from one hotel to the next, or a campsite to the next.
It's hotel nearly always. We go from one to the next, one city, and what you'll do is you'll try and get a big run in, and then the next day take 2 days to see it. Like, maybe if you're in Istanbul too, to see it,
look at the city.
Head on to the next place. And if you have a long journey, it's not that interesting.
What's a long journey? Many hours would you go for?
Oh, we've done Sweden top to bottom nearly in a day.
Jesus.
800 or 900 kilometres. And that was hard going.
Is that a kill me?
Yeah,
that
was a good drive, all right. Yeah.
Wow.
It was hardy after that. It wasn't full Sweden to be bigger, but we'd gone across to Copenhagen. And geez, I can't remember. That was a big trip. We went up to Finland from Limerick, which was great. We did 10, 11 countries in 3 weeks.
3 weeks,
which was
amazing.
And many lads was in the.
There was 14 of us, but we're in a bike club, so it's a worldwide club.
Okay.
And what we were doing was going to the European Rally. That's why we go to these destinations every year that are different.
Right, wherever that's going on.
Wherever it's gone, it was in Romania last year, but we decided to go up around Istanbul and that kind of Turkey and that area afterwards, and then back around. And they're all retired cops all around the world, so we'd up. Often start off maybe from Limerick with about 7 or 8 of us. We might meet some guys in England. We might meet some guys in Germany, Holland. There could be 30 or 40 of us by the time we get. But you don't want to drive in too big a group because it's dangerous.
Actually. I was going to say,
it's 10, 14 maybe around here. And bigger than that, and it's you're just taking up too much of the road.
Yeah.
And then when you're on these tours and like, would any of that crew or even yourself, is it all about the pints of the wine, or would food kind of come into it in any way at all? It doesn't have to, just because you're on our pod, but
it does for me.
I know you're into it anyway.
No,
like
I peeled off on my own in Istanbul 2 nights.
Yeah.
Met up with the boys after because I wanted to go to local.
Yeah.
The skin of it a little bit.
Get a proper taste.
Exactly, And I had great crack. I ordered loads of things. And you know what you're saying, I'll try. Jesus, they couldn't get over in the kitchen. They were coming out dancing. I was probably dropping as much as four fellas on their own. I was doing it, you know. Of course, I couldn't eat it all, but I had to taste it.
Yeah, you want to see it. Yeah, well, that's what chefs do all the time. Yeah, you might have three or four starters. You just want to get a wee gander at it.
Exactly.
See what it's like, steal ideas, and do whatever it tastes.
Food was incredible in Istanbul now, I have to say. Just in the local cafes and that. Just, I like that kind of like pulses and all that kind of stuff, you know, kebabs and everything.
Well, they're spice as well, as opposed to maybe more Asian spices. I mean, you'll find there in the Middle East, and that neck of the woods, like where Turkey, Jerusalem, that you mentioned Ottolenghi there earlier.
Yes.
They're more aromatic spices as opposed to heat. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So there's just unbelievable flavour, but the Irish palate isn't really, I mean, there's plenty in Ireland that are good with spice. I'm terrible. I find as I get older as well, my tolerance for it is getting worse and worse, and I love it.
Yeah.
I want to be able to eat it, but my body just fights me. I'm like, oh, give it up, and like, I'm five or six mouthfuls deep and I have to stop eating. I'm like, fuck, this is unbelievably nice, and I have to stop eating it because it just, the heat overtakes me.
Yeah,
whereas my daughter, she's 10, she couldn't make it hot enough for her, you know.
Really?
Love spice.
I love spice, and nobody else in the house does.
Yeah, so, and we potties.
My favourite story about, I remember I was living in Sydney, and this one of the lads, Tommy, went to Thailand on holidays, you know, and he came back and he was like, every morning I was eating this glass noodle salad covering these little scuds, they're these little tiny red chilies. And I was like, you were just eating chilies for your breakfast? Yeah, well, no problem to me. So I said to one of the lads, go in and get a bag of chilies there. I went into the fridge and he came out. Now, these scuds, right, they're not habaneros. They're small little Thai chilies. Yeah. So I says, here, eat one of them. And he goes, no problem. Threw it in. He nearly died.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's one of the funniest things I've ever seen in my life. He was about 4 or 5 bites in and he was like, I'm in trouble here.
Was he just talking bollocks or did?
No, I think
he was eating something else.
Yeah,
he was eating something else.
A little bit milder, but I swear to God, man, he was in the bad place. So bad.
You're a nasty fucker to do that.
We were all standing around. I swear to, I'm not even thinking of it now. But the only yogurt or milk is the only.
Oh yeah, that's good. I have a buddy, Misha.
So we hid the yogurt and the milk.
Yeah, but they'd be bubbling it into their face, man, and they're you feel like your throat's choking on you.
Yeah.
I watched that podcast that dude has. What's it called? Hot Ones, like the wings where they're eating the spice wings. I wouldn't get to the third one. I'd say I'd be on my knees licking fucking yogurt off the ground. Do you know what I mean? It's like, where's the Glenellan? Do you know what I mean? I wouldn't be able to. I couldn't cope with it, you know.
I do remember John Kenny. One of the funniest things I ever saw. He's big into his cooking as well.
Yeah.
And it was one of the first times, I was very young, about 18, just started working with him. And he was making a curry or something. He chopped a chili and then he went to the loo. Oh, yeah. And then about 2 minutes later, he started screaming. And he spent about an hour up against the sink with a tap going full bed.
Fucking everybody makes that mistake at some stage. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Oh, you rubbed the eye. Yeah. You'd be happy you rubbed your eye.
Literally.
Yeah. Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins. A Go Loud original podcast.
Giving you a helping hand with your food frustrations.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us. Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Subscribe for free on the Go Loud app and never miss an episode.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
More recent times, then, Pat, you've teamed up with your own daughter. Was it COVID that brought that on?
Yeah, it was.
Faye, right?
Faye, yeah. She was famous.
Oh,
yeah,
well, you do a little bit of
I do know that. Yeah, she told me. She keeps telling me that, all right?
Yeah.
I'm very jealous. But
because I could tell by her that she's a foodie, you know? She's really interested
she
in it.
She is very interested.
And normally when you meet somebody like that, it's the whole family. So it was evident to me that there was a bit of cooking going on.
She does. She's a good cook herself as well. But she was finishing college when COVID happened, and she was planning to head off with a couple of girls to London, you know, do the auditions and live the dream kind of thing. But of course, no travelling, nothing happening. And we found ourselves sitting in the back garden. I remember one day, just a glass of wine going, I said, look, why don't we just start writing shit, doing stuff, because that's what we do.
Yeah.
and we need to keep going while COVID's happening, you know. Yeah. So we started messing around with a camera and a few characters in the garden and having the crack with sketches, and it was so funny. And she's hilariously funny as well, to be fair to her.
So what did she study at college, pal? Like,
well, she did drama school.
Not,
yeah,
yeah,
she
I was
did what is it? Not Gaiety School of Acting.
Yes.
Then she went on and did Bow Street for film acting as well. So.
Lovely.
So and was comedy the route that she was going to take?
No, or? No, not at all. I think she kind of went away from comedy because I was doing comedy.
Yeah, yeah.
And not to be kind of. You know, yeah, but her lecturers in college are going, why aren't you doing comedy? Like, you're so funny. And there's a thing about comedy as well. Not everybody has the comic bone, which is about timing and everything. You know, I'm sure you guys as chefs know something similar from a chef's point of view, but from an acting point of view, there's loads of different strands of acting and things that some people are really good at. The likes of Barry Keoghan, like, is just an incredible film actor. And I haven't seen him on stage, but he's got he's got that kind of
it.
It's like Clint Eastwood, you know. It's that not saying a whole lot, but got presence.
Yeah, he has. Yeah, he really does. Yeah, so he's a unique looking guy.
Exactly.
Too,
and he's brilliant. You know, so you can see that. And comedy is something similar. You can see people with great comic bones,
funny bones.
You know, and for some reason we don't get a whole lot of women doing it. I don't know for what reason.
Yeah.
That seems to be changing of late, isn't it?
It is changing. I know there's a lot more female stand-ups, and I'm talking about probably in the comic acting end.
Okay.
But it's, and a lot of people tend to veer towards drama.
And when the women are good, they're unbelievable. And you Tina Fey and some of the American Office, like, and some of those. I mean, Jesus, the women steal the show in a lot of the scenes.
Amy Huberman is one of best, like, comic actresses. You know, she's when she's in comedy stuff, she's just fantastic. She nails it every time, and she's also a good drama actress. But it's funny.
It's time and facial expression, everything. Yeah, it's very. Yeah, it's, can that be taught? Like,
I think it's much more. I think it was, as you said, there's a lot more now. Years ago, it wasn't so much, and I think maybe because the drama schools are more, like, when I started acting and doing films and TV and stuff, there might have been only one school in the whole country.
Yeah,
80 was starting up at the time. Not in Trinity, not in other places, UCC and all this. Now UCD, UCC, they all have acting courses.
What's changed, I think?
Well, I just think the industry's grown big in Ireland. There's no question of it. It's like,
how do you get that start in acting? Like, is it from the drama school or college then, that just auditions are, you're trying to get into, not everything, but everything that's of interest to you? Like, say now, Garage, like the movie. Yeah. Like, I mean, did you, like, were you part of the writing process
as
well?
No,
you were cast for that.
I was cast before it was finished writing. They had me in mind from the start.
Right.
And I'd worked with Lenny on commercials and stuff like that. And I knew Mark. I'd worked with him as an actor. We worked together. So I knew all the team involved in it. And they knew me. And that's why Lenny had kind of thought I was the right person for the job. And then when Mark was writing it, he was writing it with me in mind as well.
Yeah, wow.
Which was a great.
Because that was a big change from what we all knew.
It was huge for me.
Unbelievable.
Yeah. I think because it opened up, it was a very serious role.
Unbelievable.
And people were... People are used to me comedy, but not just comedy, but exaggerated, almost clowning with the Unbelievables, wigs, you know, exaggerated expressions and all that kind of stuff. And this was then complete film. It's like I was talking about Barry Keoghan, much more subtle, you know, film. You're on a huge big screen. And there's, like, you know, when they talk about TV, stage TV and film, you know, you're on TV, you play up a little bit because the screen is so small in the corner of the room, or at least used to be. Then with film, you don't go that big because...
No more subtle.
Well, you're going to be huge on a screen, so it's all about subtlety. And then you go to stage, you got to let the person know at the back of the theatre what's going on.
And do you have anything you prefer? Like, what's your...
I love stage, I have to say. I mean, I enjoy all... it's great. They're all different and challenging in different ways once you understand the medium and how to go about it. But it's hard to be, like, me and Faye are out 3-4 nights a week on stage every week, touring around the country and all over. And it's hard to beat a live audience, a reaction from, you know, I'm sure it's like being in a restaurant, you know. And
have you ever had a shocker? Like, I'm sure everybody has, like, Tumbleweed City.
Yes and no, in a sense. Yeah. Yes, of course, we've all had the night where you come back and you say, what am I having?
Yeah.
What am I doing?
What the just fuck the is going fucking on?
Hell. Yeah. So, Jesus Christ. But sometimes, then again, of course, you blame the audience.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Bunch of
ignorant jurors of shower of whores. They wouldn't know Taylor if it jumped up in front of them.
Yeah, yeah.
And then there's nights, this is a strange one, but I'm sure you found this probably in dining rooms, maybe. At some, there's theatres that you go into that are so soundproofed that, and designed in such a way that you don't get the feedback on the stage. Well, they could be down on the floor roaring laughing.
Oh,
and you
shit.
Can't hear it.
And that's awful.
Oh, you're rattled.
Yeah.
You base a lot of your timing and everything off the flow.
Yes,
the laughter coming to you. And when you don't think it's coming, you think, what am I doing fucking wrong?
Yeah. Well, we had the chef from Chapter One here a couple of weeks ago,
yeah.
2-star Michelin chef. And
yeah.
He spent a lot of his time speaking about how dining rooms should be a fun place, and
yeah.
where there's a misconception. Well, I think we've discussed it lots about Michelin star restaurants. There is like upper echelons,
yeah.
and like you can't go in and have the crack. And he was like,
yeah.
come in and have the crack. Like, yeah. we're going to take a lot of money off you, so you should be enjoying
yeah.
yourself.
Yeah.
And if you're not, then yeah. you shouldn't be coming.
We want
here.
You laughing no, as we ride, yeah.
I couldn't agree more with you, and you guys being in the industry probably know that.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
people, some people do. Do we used to have a particular theatre down the country? I won't mention it, but when, years ago, I think it's not so much anymore. When I was working with John, like you're going back 30 years, and we do a week's run in the theatre, and we used to call Saturday nights the Fur Coat Brigade. Because they were theatre goers. Mm. Everyone else was out fucking jamming.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
And then Saturday night you come along and they were like.
And you would think it's going to be the biggest night.
You think it would be because
yeah,
it's the middle of
now.
The weekend.
Yeah.
It's impressed me now and they were theatre people. You know? A bit like that. They couldn't fucking enjoy themselves, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's a killer, you know what I mean? Because, Gareth and I, we would do food festivals and all sorts of, apart from obviously TV, radio, yeah. podcasts and all that crack, which is easy. But whenever you go to a food festival, I mean, you could be at Bord Bay, there could be 2,000 people standing yeah. in front of you in the Phoenix Park, like whenever you're in the main stage
yeah,
of
yeah.
Bloom. But it's partly stand-up comedy. Oh. Like if you're not actually having, not to taint us as being good enough to be comedians, but you're definitely, if you're not having the crack with the audience, they're not interested in how you make a fucking roux. You know what I mean? Like, there has to be some sort of...
has to be a bit of fun.
Oh, there has to be. There has to be yeah. absolutely fun. And I find,
You done a...
We did Middleton when we had the pub below.
Oh, right.
Okay. And because it's an Irish team pub, I dressed up a load of traditional musicians in the chef's outfits.
Oh, yeah.
And Mike Hannon and myself did the demonstration. And we got the Bowron player to whip cream for the whole team. Just so he wouldn't play the Bowron.
He's that good.
He was standing there the whole time. Just
and when Faye told you she was going down the world of acting, I'm often asked about, your kids go into it. Yeah. Were you glad or were you nervous or were you...
I always kind of say it was good to me. So if it's good to me, it'll be good to her. She's got a good work attitude. And
that's
it's tough,
isn't it?
It is.
It
is tough. And she's a grafter. She's like, she gets out and she works, she even... goes to load the van at the end of the night with the crew and I'm going, come on, Faye.
Yeah.
I want to go to the pub.
Yeah, yeah.
You're holding me up. But no, she's a grafter and I thought, look, she's not going to... The worst part of my game is rejection when you get auditions.
Well, I was just about to go down that route. Hey, yeah.
That's the worst part.
Yeah.
And you really need... Like, I'm strong enough now and I've done enough and I kind of run my own office. Me and Faye do. We book out our own gigs. We've our own production house and touring gear and everything else. So if we don't get a job in a TV show or something or a film, it's not the end of the world. But you're constantly being asked to do self-tapes now. That's the worst part of it. And Jesus.
Is that the new audition?
It is. Everybody.
Even after all the body of work that you would have out there.
Yeah, well, some directors will come looking for me.
Yeah.
And I get those jobs. But you're also self-taping for gigs. I'm doing one tomorrow for some American movie coming up. Even some of the big name actors will end up having to do a self-tape because the directors want to see
and you have
the
to
look.
Make peace with that.
Yeah. You just got to get on with it. But it's soul destroying initially.
And do you ever get used to that type of rejection? No.
I don't think so.
No.
I don't think it's that,
It's probably if a complaint comes in, right, and you're, it's the nature of the beast. I remember learning, I used to really get myself caught up in if someone had a poor dining experience.
Yeah.
But then you have to, in my world, it's about the service recovery. So it's about we got it wrong. I'm really sorry. Come back and we're going to get it right for you. And occasionally, and then sometimes you just can't play with some people.
No.
Without a bit of a right there, you're just kind of going, right, well, look. But I think if you can stand over your body of work, and I suppose it's like, we've in a creative job as well, like you have to just be able to stand over every dish that goes out and, hope people enjoy it.
In our game, you just might not be right for the job.
Yeah.
That's the other side.
And it's a big lesson to a lot of people, you know, that are maybe up and coming in your neck of the woods. I mean, even after 20, 30 plus years of real success, like genuine success, that could probably shock some of them to be, they're probably coming out of college, maybe at phase age now and thinking, oh, sure, I was brilliant at my last play. Like, why am I sending you tapes or whatever? And you're like going, well, I've been rocking and rolling in full theatres for the guts of your whole lifetime. And I'm still and getting told that I'm fucking useless the odd day here and there.
It makes the
acceptance days, and you enjoy them better.
Exactly. I mean, there was one film I auditioned for a few years, 2 years ago or so, and I was full sure I had it. I nailed the bloody thing. And I didn't get it. And then the film came out and Colin Farrell was in the part. I thought, okay.
Fair enough. not so bad. I think you're probably sitting there waiting for about 18 months going, what motherfucker is it?
Who got this?
Simon Delaney, you prick.
You know? I didn't say that.
Simon's a good buddy. I can call him a prick. It's all right. Wow. And you and Faye going back on tour just now? You're in the middle of one.
We're touring up to the end of July. Up June, and then I have another kind of one or two things.
And where's the favourite venue in Ireland?
I don't know.
I know you probably have to go with home turf, but is there one of the big ones up here?
Yeah, I do think Limerick, Consol Limerick is a fantastic venue.
Right.
Great crew there. We know them all. They're all friends of ours, and I worked with them all one time or another. And it is kind of like a home gig for Turles is another one. It's like a home.
Well, you're a Turles boy, right? You're from there,
And then like the Olympia. I love doing the Olympia in Dublin. It's just, you know.
The history.
Yeah. It's like the Everyman in Cork, you know. It's that really gorgeous old Victorian theatre.
Yeah.
Waterford, we were there recently. That's another beautiful theatre. Designed by the same architect as designed the Olympia. So it's like a miniature. It's 400 seater. And the Olympia's, 1,000 or 200.
Yeah.
It's like a miniature of the Olympia.
And when you go overseas, do you have to adapt your work?
No.
Just go.
Because your fans, the Irish people are everywhere aren't they?
We'll be doing London. Yeah, you will have a lot of
Irish. Not saying there's only Irish people going to watch you. But
You're right. We're predominantly Irish, but then we do get mixed of all types. You know, because take New York, for example. It's a great theatre-going audience. And somebody will come along to see Pat Short in New York that might never have any connections with Ireland, but just to see something Irish.
Yeah.
Now, I always make the kind of point that, you know, if you go to see the Bolshoi Ballet, you want to see Russian ballet.
Yeah.
You don't want to see River Dance first.
You want to see a Mark Savage from Thurles.
Just because they're in Dublin doing it. Do you know what I mean? So that's what you want. So the same as when we go abroad, we give the Irish comedy and we'll do it as we do it. Maybe have to slow down a little bit every now and again.
Yeah. Because I remember Gareth lived in Australia for many years and I was in Boston for six. And you know, when you're a fan of stuff, and especially if you weren't coming back, like I remember Mammy coming over one time, and I wouldn't have been a big fan of the Saw Doctors, but they were on during a 2 week period that the Old Doll was visiting, and I took her and my auntie there, to watch. But in Donegal, that's a term of endearment, by the way. Don't the Old Doll, if you called her anything else, she'd be offended. But anyway, so I took the Old Doll and my auntie Carmel to the Saw Doctors at the Paradise Club. Fuck me, man. I've watched those boys now in more places than you could. I've never seen a band as good live. They are mental.
Utter mental.
They're stonewall touched.
Oh, did you?
I did for about 3 weeks in the States, yeah.
Jesus Christ.
I know the lads for years. And the first gig, I play sax. So the sax player, Richard Buckley, was leaving.
Did you ever play Canton in Boston with them, by any chance? Canton, the GAA?
Where do we do in Boston? We did
it Roxy.
Bar in Boston. Where it was a big enough place.
We used to play Paddy's Week or Paddy's Night in Boston. All the Guinness used to bring them over because they sponsored our team. So the whole team would go, oh man, you chat about a hoedown.
But I never forget doing the first gig with them. Jesus, after they finish up the last tune, he's like, "Nice, Aaron." And then say, "All right, we're going out for an encore." We're back out for another hour. So I was like, "Jesus, lads, I'm gonna
fucking gasping."
We'll talk about Sydney. I did Sydney a few years back, and I did it all across Australia. But I had the promoter come in to me at halftime. He said, "Short, you're not going to believe it. The crack below at the front. There was a merchandise stall, and a young one from Australia, from the area, working there, and about 300 paddies, all langers going, yeah. How much is one of them? And she go, "That's $20. And they all rolled around laughing. She had no idea what they were on about.
Oh Jesus, the poor girl. Oh, that's a fucking nightmare.
Well, come here, we have a tradition on the pod towards the end. We used to get people to bring in a book, but now it's a desert island meal, so you need to tell us your last, and it can be as something as extra. Nevin McGuire was there last week and he gave us a nine course.
He's a greedy hero though.
Yeah. So is there anything that you crave for, if you're maybe when you're travelling? Or
I love a good kebab.
Oh, do you?
I do. Yeah, now, not talking about, like, there's a place down in Limerick called City Grill. I was in there recently and they've got the proper pots they cook in, and oh, it's Afghanistan. And,
I'm disappointed that you haven't gone with the chicken hut.
No,
I can't believe the chicken hut hasn't got a shout, man.
The chicken hut,
yeah, have you not? You're not living, man. A gravy chip, sweet Jesus. The chicken hut is the holy grail.
The bag you go. Did you hear that story? I think there's t-shirts.
Yeah, there is.
But yeah, you can't beat the proper kebab with the bread baked there in front of you and all the different onions and...
All those pickles well, don't they? All the pickled cabbage.
Well, you're spot on there, right? There's a place I came on by accident one day. I remember I could have texted you, Gareth. I sent more messages. I was just wandering around the streets waiting to come in here, I think, one evening. And up past Whelan's, it's got a real long or weird name, but it's on the opposite side of the street to Whelan's, about five or six doors up.
Where Hang Dai is?
Right near Hang Dai, yeah. The name will come to me now, but there's a kebab place there too. Oh,
savage.
My days. It's next level, sir. So when you say there, like, you're not chatting about some rusty gaff at the corner of...
These boys do sea bass and
everything. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Like, they do everything, and it's...
What's it called? Give him a shout out again.
It's called the City Grill.
City
Grill. It's down at the Milk Market in Limerick.
Ah, yeah.
Can't miss it. But yeah, I hope they do well because I like it. Yeah.
You've given them enough beans over the years anyway. Well, listen, Pat, thanks a million, for coming in. It's a big catch.
I'll never answer the phone to you when I'm drunk.
Yeah.
He woke up today.
He woke up regretting it.
I woke up this morning with all those Jesus.
Yeah. He thought it was a Zoom call. Thanks so much, Pat. Wishing you and Faye massive success in the show.
Thanks, Gareth. Thank you very much.
So next up, we've got our culinary conundrum. So it's over to our resident Ed chef.
There it is.
What have we got?
It is wicked, wicked. Yes. So we've got a load of great questions in this week. So we're going to kick off immediately with a very short and sweet one from Derek. If you could invite three chefs around for dinner, who would you invite? And would the chefs you invite help prepare the food? And what dish would you cook for each chef?
That was a quick one.
Very few words, but he makes every one of them count, does Derek.
Okay, I'll go with that one first. I'd Ramsay right away for me. I really, people have mixed opinions on Ramsay. I adore him. I think I just admired his whole career, the work ethic. Just unbelievable. Really, really love him. So I would have Ramsay. And then Colin Fastnach is a chef from Ireland that's doing really, really well in Australia. We follow each other online. I don't know Colin at all on a personal level, but I love his mannerisms. He seems like a mad hoor. He seems like a type of dude that if I was living in Australia, me and him would be best pals, and I wouldn't have to do a podcast with Gareth. I'd be doing it with him. he looks like, he seems like a talented guy. Really, really nice. I don't know, do you know him from your time? I think he maybe went after your time.
Yeah,
but he's done really well over there. And then a third chef, I'm going to, Jesus. There's loads that I really, Rick Steen. Oh, yeah. Rick Steen, the master. He was just if I'm talking about chefs alive, I mean, Keith Floyd would probably trump them all, you know what I mean? Because Floyd and Gary Rhodes were the two. I mean, I blame Gary Rhodes for a lot of my bad haircuts as a teenager.
What do you mean as a blading teenager? Well,
Gary Rhodes, the bad haircuts just stayed. But sadly, Gary Rhodes passed on. But he was the only one on TV back then. He had the maddest of hairdos. And I had the bravery to do the same thing. And really and truly, Floyd was on the box. Gary Rhodes on the box. I loved him. Really loved him. And then Rick Steen, actually, yeah. He was, you know, Floyd found him. Like, it was, I think, David Collier. I'm trying to think of the producer's name now. But Floyd was a big fan of Rick Steen's. And he said to his producer, he goes, listen, you got to come and see this guy. And sure enough, the rest is history. I would have got to know Jack Steen really well, and I do know him still quite well. Rick's son, I cooked against him in the competition a long time ago. We stayed pals. Really, Rick Steen's just such a confident cook, like such a lovely, he just has a from a million miles away, you know that he's just a sorcerer with seasoning and cooking. No airs of grace.
He used to eat in a restaurant I worked in Sydney. I don't know, he has a place over there.
Bannister's outside of Sydney.
Maybe his wife is Australian, or he definitely has a connection to Sydney.
Yeah, so he's got a place called Bannister's not far from Sydney. Yeah.
Well, used to do an oyster festival in the restaurant that we worked in. So he's
so that's my
he's
three,
big into seafood. So.
And as for cooking for them, look, I would happily let them sit down and I'd cook for them. No problem. What about you? Who are you going?
Kaufman.
Yeah.
I think it'd have to be one. I've been in our company loads of times, but Doreena Allen, every time I'm in our company,
lady.
She's the stories she has about Irish food are incredible. And I like her approach to dining and the dining table. I think she always talks about taking your time and like really trying to enjoy the conversation, and I think that's where you find a good guest. And her knowledge of Irish food is unreal. And I like what Angela Hartnett is doing at the moment over in the UK. She has a podcast as well around food, and I just think she's a very interesting career. She's actually Ramsay trained. There's a lot of well, they all started with Marco and then they went and worked with Ramsay. So there's a lot of chefs over there that I keep my eye on career-wise.
Yeah.
And she's one that I'd love to cook. And I think if she was coming, I'd ask her to make some pasta because...
Is it Murano she has?
Yeah. That's her thing. And I'd do the spuds and Karina and Derek, and they can just sit back. So that's
a good question,
Nice one, Derek. Okay, we're going down to Kells now. Tanya... Quick question for you both that might be beneath two of our finest chefs, but here goes. What is your favorite sandwich?
Oh, I love a Cubano, I have to say.
What's a Cubano?
A Cubano is, it's actually almost made famous in the movie Chef as well. If you ever watch that movie Chef with Jon Favreau, you see a Cubano on there. But when I make a Cubano anyway, I would have had one on a menu in Boston back in the day. And now whether it's a classic Cubano or not, it's the only way I know it. But I do it on a ciabatta and butter the outside first of all. Then on the inside, I do this sort of like a honey mustard dressing on the actual bread. Then roast loin of pork, like a sort of roast spiced loin of pork. Cool down, and then it's shaved onto that, like so thin slices of pork loin, then thinly sliced pickle on top of that, barbecue sauce, and then you can maybe do another layer again, and then like a really deep sharp cheddar cheese, top it off with the ciabatta again, a wee bit more barbecue sauce and honey mustard as well, or mustard straight up Dijon if you want to make it a bit stronger. The dressing's a wee bit lighter. You want the barbecue kind of to come out a wee bit, and then into like a sandwich press, butter the outside only, never the inside, and grill that down, split it. Beautiful. Absolutely one of the nicest sandwiches you'll ever eat's a Cubano. There you go. I must make you one someday.
Yeah, I need to write that down.
Garrett, go ahead. Tater sandwich. Is it a tater sandwich?
No. It has to be a croque madame.
Oh.
Yeah, so a really fancy ham and cheese toasted sandwich. Oh, yeah.
Reared on them, were you?
Hmm?
Reared on them.
I used to be able to smell the brioche toasting as I walked up down the Clibarrock Road on the way to Donamead.
So what's your trick then for a...
Really, it's about the bechamel. You have to get the white sauce right, and then Gruyere cheese is my go-to for a croque madame. And then... Then it's just a toasted sandwich, and then it's layered with the bechamel, and then you put more cheese on top, and then you underneath the grill, so you gratinate it. If you're ever in France, that's kind of where they're at. If you see one, get one. They'd sell them in all.
It's basically a ham and cheese toasty top of white sauce and cheese.
It's a notions toasty, but
they're next level, man.
They're very, very
great
good.
Question, Tanya. So we're going up now. Tom in Black Rock. Absolutely adore the pod. I have the family driven mad experimenting with all your brilliant tips and tricks. Gary, I have a similar problem to you trying to get the kids enthusiastic about a proper Sunday roast. This is something you've mentioned a few times on the pods. I'm trying to up my game, and whilst doing some research, saw it mentioned that the key to success for the best roast chicken is to brine and dry the skin. Is this true? And if so, how do I go about it? Thanks a million, Tom, County Louth.
Absolutely spot on, yeah. Brine and dine is the way to go, yeah. Anything that has a bone at all should be brined, okay? And basically a brine solution is a way where a joint of meat or a carcass of meat or whatever will take in, it'll absorb moisture and hold it in, but it'll also be seasoning it as it does it. So a brine solution is basically a salt, sugar, water solution with aromatics, and you'll bring it up to a boil. Oh, you don't even need to bring it to a boil. You bring it up to temperature, really, just to make sure that the sugar and everything melts in. It activates all the aromatics, gets them work, and then you make sure that that's completely chilled. You'll set your whole chicken, if you're going to roast the whole chicken, set it into it the day before you want to roast it. You take it out, you pat dry it, put it in the fridge then, leave it in the fridge for 2 or 3 hours, uncovered, and let the fan of the fridge actually help dry out the skin a wee bit. And then you're going to roast it as you normally roast the chicken. But that brining part of it, the chicken has been absorbing the salt. It's been seasoning the meat. It's withholding the water as well. So then when you roast it and you rest, but you must rest it after you've roasted it, and then you'll get the benefit of the brine solution. And you're really, really penetrating the meat with the salt solution. And it's the only way to go. Beautiful.
I think one of the biggest mistakes people make at home when they're roasting something is that they start off with the temperature too low. Like, I think people are nervous about getting up past 180 degrees.
Is everybody dried out, or are people afraid it's going to dry
out? Yeah, I think that's what it is. But, like, what you're looking for when you're roasting anything is the natural sugars that were in, whether it's a chicken or a turkey or a piece of beef or a piece of lamb. You're looking for them to caramelize. That's where the flavor is. So, like, when I roast the chicken, I start it off at like 220 degrees for the first half an hour, and then follow the process that Gary says. But if you haven't had time to brine it, just make sure you season it really well, the inside of the carcass, all around the board, drizzle it in a little bit of olive oil. And when I say season, it can be as simple as salt, or you can do a rosemary salt or a smoked paprika salt or whatever angle you want to go with flavour, and then start it off nice and hot. Then when you pop that cold ish chicken, like, take it out of the fridge 40 minutes before it goes into the oven to allow it come to room temperature, then pop it into the oven, roast it for the first half an hour at 220, and then leave the door closed and lower it down to 180 190, and then like a 1.2 kilo chicken is going to take like an hour and 10 minutes. Like, it's not 2.5 hours. I think that's the two things. Yeah. That's how it gets dry. People stay around 170 180, and they leave it in there for way too long.
Oh, okay.
And if you are roasting a lot, buy a little meat thermometer. It's the only way to go, because it takes all the guesswork out. And then the last, probably as important as your meat thermometer, is allowing the meat to rest. Like, if you've cooked something for an hour, it probably needs to rest for 25 minutes, half an hour. And all it does, it retains all the moisture. And then just carve away. I think we spoke about it a few weeks ago. Yeah. Take the wishbone out.
That's right.
That's going to get all the breast meat off. And that's it.
Great questions. Super simple. Again, thank you so much, listeners. And don't forget, you can keep those questions coming into us at food@goaloutnow.com.
Okay, another episode done and dusted. And as we suspected, we had a lunatic on our hands.
A great laugh.
Yeah, I mean, such high energy. Like, sometimes you look in at these lads' careers and these girls' careers that have such success, and across so many different platforms.
Yeah.
But you can see why, as like, his energy is infectious, and it need to be when you're standing up on a stage trying to entertain an audience. Or
I couldn't believe he said yes to coming on. Like, I sent him a message, he's going to tell me to go catch yourself on, will you?
I didn't realise he was in so many different, like, I mean, I suppose it's my naivety and ignorance, I suppose, a little bit, but I knew he acted a little bit, and I really thought comedy was his main bag, but look, he's a serious actor.
Oh, no, he's a serious actor, and he's a serious musician, because I've seen him on stage with the Sad Doctors and on his own.
And I bet you...
And a saxophone's one of the nicest instruments, by the way. What a lovely
instrument. I would say his artwork, I think he was being very modest there.
I'd love to see a lot more of that.
I would too.
Yeah, because I love art myself, man. I was like, Jesus, man, like, can you not see it anywhere? He obviously has it all banged up or locked up somewhere.
But you don't think of that. Like, when you ask them, or one of us asked them, how do you do it, or when do you do the art? And like, when you're at a movie, you have so much time to kill.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think any of these creative people generally dip their toe into music, acting, comedy. Not everybody has the success that he has across so many platforms. So
yeah, and it was really interesting to hear him. Like, he just, as I was about to ask him, actually, I was like thinking, God, I wonder, does he have to deal with rejection as well? And but I mean, I didn't expect it to be to the level of what he was saying. You could really see it in his eyes, like that. Jesus, some of the put downs or the roles that you don't get, and he's thinking to himself, how am I at this stage in life still dealing? But you know, it's a lesson for a lot of, I suppose, younger people too, like whatever, that it's sadly it is a part of life, really, when you when you put yourself in that type of situation, whether it's, you know, acting and going for roles. I mean, sure, the country's awash with unbelievable talent as well, like, and I suppose it's a mark of the man as well that he's stood to the fore for so many years, you know what I mean? Certainly he's had way more successes than rejections anyway, and
for sure,
magic to get him on. Yeah.
Okay, well, look, that's another episode done and dusted. And all, as always, if you're enjoying the show, now comment really helps. You know, we're trying to get the...
share the love.
Share the love, exactly. Yeah, comments really help, and sharing on across your own socials. So, yeah, that's another episode done. We'll talk to you next week.
Dishing It Out with Gary O'Hanlon and Gareth Mullins, a Go Loud original podcast.
Subscribe for free on the Go Loud app and never miss an episode.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.